Hi, I'm Dave Champion.
And I'm Bill Carnes.
And together we are totally unprepared. Well, this is the first segment where we talk about something topical out of the news. And we've each got a little something we're going to talk about. This is really, yes, it's news, but it's almost like entertainment. It's almost like obscene entertainment, okay? Here's the deal. Years ago, 20, 25 years ago, there was a terrorist attack in Argentina. And an investigation at that time showed that the people behind the terrorist attack was the nation of Iran. So Argentina's legislature passed laws saying nobody who does business in Argentina can do business with Iran. Well, fast forward to 2014, 2015. Now Argentina wants to buy Iranian oil. So Cristina Kirchner, the president of Argentina, she tells this prosecutor to do an investigation. And it appears that it was a complete whitewash cover-up job, and of course it found Iran harmless, because this is all oil politics, right? So then somebody else in the government tasks another prosecutor with investigating the investigation, and he pretty much finds out it's a cover-up driven by Cristina.
Yeah, we want to get oil. Yep. So this the outcome of this decades-old investigation doesn't help us in that. So we want you to reinvestigate it, and here's the findings that you're going to end up with. Yes. At the end of this investigation, is what they're told.
So now the secondary prosecutor comes behind the corrupt prosecutor, and he's investigating the investigation. And he determines that the whole thing was a cover-up and a whitewash, and Cristina Kirchner is behind it. And he's about to issue his report, and he starts telling some of his friends and peers that he's pretty sure he's going to get killed before he can get the report out. And just a couple of days after that, he winds up what I refer to as suicided. Now,
yeah.
Argentina's sort of the U.S. equivalent of the Secretary of Homeland Security comes out and says, you know, all the indicators point to suicide. Except today, they just released information that there's no gun. Now, he's supposed to have shot himself in the head. There is no gunpowder residue found on this man's hands, right?
Right.
Bill, tell them. There's all prosecutors. The original prosecutor, then the prosecutor that was doing the cover-up, then the prosecutor that was prosecuting the prosecutor, and he got whacked, and now there's another prosecutor investigating the death of the prosecutor. So what did that prosecutor say that you and I were busting up about at lunch?
He said that because the weapon used was a .22, it obviously, it's very possible that it didn't give enough gunpowder residue to leave enough on there. Now, I cry total BS on that. You might remember several years ago, post 9/11, they're putting in all this new goofy equipment at the airports, and they had this thing that you'd walk through, and I called it the puff machine. It would puff, 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 and it would pick up anything that blew off of you or your clothes, looking for explosive residue.
Right. I called it the sniffer.
So the being in the firearms training industry, I hadn't fired a gun in a few days. And the clothes I was wearing had been laundered since the last time I wore them in any sort of shooting occasion.
Yep.
But yet it picked up residue off of that. I was clean several times. The clothes were clean at least a couple of times right. Since then. Yet they picked something up. I missed my flight. Not because they were, I'm a firearms instructor. Here's my card. Here's my information, blah, blah, blah. And what it was is they needed to reset the machine before the next person could come through, who was my daughter I was flying with. Had she gone through first, and then I got held up at the puff machine, we still would have just made the flight. Because it was literally, had just pulled away from the gate. It was 20 feet away from the gate when we ran up there. We were literally a minute late.
Right. So now, what Bill is saying, his experience was his clothes had been laundered, his hands had been washed. That dovetails completely with what forensics experts tell us today. They say that the residue from firing a firearm cannot be readily washed off, even with several washings. Right. Now, back in my day, probably in your day, there was the paraffin test. That's old news now. Then the next iteration was something called a 5% nitrate solution to find it. And that's gone now. And now they use something called SEM. I can't remember what it stands for. Scan something.
It's all electronic, all digital. Yeah, all computerized.
And they're saying with the new techniques, the real problem is not that there would be too little, which is what this idiot, this corrupt prosecutor is trying to do to cover up the murder of the righteous prosecutor, trying to claim there was not enough residue, which is nonsense. You and I know this. But right now, forensics experts are saying the problem they have, because the equipment is so sensitive now, that if you were around somebody who fired a gun earlier in the day or yesterday, or it was on their clothes or jacket, and you're like sitting at the same table having dinner with them, that they can find residue on you and you haven't touched a gun. And yet this prosecutor is trying to claim that a .22 caliber wouldn't put out enough residue for one of these hypersensitive devices to actually detect the residue.
You know, you would all be doing us all a favor, you corrupt politicians, if you just came out and said, look, in this particular, so look, we want to buy oil from Iran. We can't because of this. So in order to rectify it, we've got to go back and show that this didn't actually happen. So that's what we're going to do. Just so you know, it's in an effort to buy oil. We know what happened, but we're going to play like it didn't so we can buy oil because these are our political motives.
We're going to create a public lie.
Then you don't have to actually lose all sense of credibility. You don't have to kill an innocent investigator who's probably good at his job. You don't have to corrupt others into it. Just say, look, this is what we need to accomplish, and this is why we need to accomplish. So in that effect, this is what we're going to do, and we're just going to re-script this entire thing and call it good so we can buy oil from the Iranians.
Yeah. Now, I want to point out this stuff.
What's wrong with going up the street and buying oil from the Venezuelans?
I don't know.
It's a lot closer. They got plenty.
There might be political issues there. We don't know. Now, if you think this only happens in, I don't know if Argentina is considered a third world
country.
It is,
yeah, sure.
But it doesn't. It happens here. Vince Foster, okay? My opinion.
Yeah. Blame the dead guy, Vince Foster.
Yeah, my opinion whacked at the directions of Hillary Clinton, okay? Found in a Washington, D.C. park with laying on his back, the gun in his hand, and Bill, you know as a police officer, how often does the gun stay in the hand when you commit suicide?
Only when somebody sets it up that
correct.
Way.
Correct. And the most telling part of that whole story was supposedly he shot himself in the head, but at the scene in the park where they discovered the body, they found this much blood. Zero blood on the ground, right? As if, like, he shot himself through the head and it was all internal bleeding, right?
Oh, yeah. It was like, what was it, Flight 93 that crashed into the field in Pennsylvania, and there's no plane wreckage there.
Right, right.
Not a single body.
Yeah. And the Washington, D.C. police said, oh, yeah, suicide. Yeah. So this happens in this country. This is what happens when you have – I'm going to come right out and say it. This is what happens when you have a police state. In a police state, powerful politicians tell the police, this is going to be the outcome of your investigation. And if there's somebody standing in the way, you kill them. That's the way it goes.
Yeah, and you do that because for whatever reason you believe that this other human being has so much more over you that you feel that you need to be their bitch,
and,
really.
And, yeah, justified.
Their lemming.
Justified in killing somebody to protect your own shenanigans. You had something else you wanted to talk about.
Did I?
Yeah, what was it?
I don't remember. Now, you know what it was? It was about how Obama has decided that he wants to provide just unilaterally virtually $12 billion to Iran so that they can build nuclear facilities for nuclear energy.
Yes.
Unilateral decision. First of all, we're going to amnesty to any illegals that are here. Then we're going to raise all the restrictions on Cuba. Then we're going to...
And we're not
going to
deport people.
No, we're not going to deport anybody. We're going to now give $12 billion to a country that is so far in debt in the hole. $12 billion we don't have.
That's this country, yeah.
To a country we know we don't get along with, mm-hmm. that weekly has death to America marches since the 70s. Every week, they're going to give you guys $12 billion and build a bunch of nuclear facilities there. And challenged Congress by saying, send me legislation to contradict what I'm going to do under foreign affairs, mm-hmm. under my purview of foreign affairs, that's veto-proof. Otherwise, I'm just going to veto it.
Yeah.
So what we have now is we have a president who has decided what he's going to do is whatever the hell he wants through executive authority. Mm-hmm. And if Congress cannot give him veto override proof
legislation
on whatever he does, he's going to continue to do it, rewriting the whole balance of power on his own.
Yep.
And Congress, quite honestly, their primary option here would be impeachment.
Right.
But there's not a single sack in Washington, in the House, that would write those impeachment papers.
That is correct. And it's funny because on my show, the Dave Champion Show, I've talked about You know, people get mad at a president. They scream impeachment. And not everything that they scream impeachment about is impeachable, right?
No, not at all.
And they've looked at very specific things that make them angry. It might be Iran. It might be Iraq. It might be whatever, the immigration issue. They get angry about that. And I want to impeach him because he's not doing it my way, which, of course, is not the standard for impeachment. But I have said, especially when it comes to immigration, that when the president takes his oath of office, when he raises that right hand and he swears it in front of 330 million Americans, he says that he takes an oath to, and I quote, faithfully execute the laws of the union. Okay? So Congress passes the law. It's on the books. He has given his oath. That is, to me, that is the fundamental requirement of his job position. If he doesn't fulfill that, he's gone. And that's the way I see
the oath. Enough. Okay? Fair enough.
To faithfully execute the laws of the union. And I think it is manifestly obvious that certainly in the immigration area, he has simply chosen to say, I know that's what the law says, and we're not going to do that.
In fact, he's come out over the last two or three years, Dave, and in several other speeches. Matter of fact, Sean Hannity put together a great excerpt along a timeline of all of these things where Obama had come out regarding the immigration issue and saying, I don't have the authority to do that. If I had the authority through executive privilege to be able to do that, I would. He said all these different things that where he admitted he didn't have the authority to do it, and then he went and did it anyhow.
Right.
Sean Hannity did a great job at putting that out. So what we have is we have the president and, quite honestly, his lackeys that are helping to direct this play, that are helping to adjust these strings. These are the folks that are actually working on getting this done. And we also this is also a guy that when he first ran in 2008 said the Bush administration has garnished far too much executive authority. That needs to be replaced back where it belongs, a lot of it in the hands of Congress. And, of course, the opposite of this has happened.
I think every presidential candidate sings that song.
Yeah, nobody says, I want to raise taxes, strip authority from the other branches, and strip your liberties away from you. Nobody runs on that ticket. However, they all seem to do it to one level or another.
I wonder if there's backroom conversations where they actually say, okay, here's what we're going to tell everybody, and then when we get elected, here's what we're actually going to do. I think we can pretty much count on that.
Probably.
All right, stay with us. When we come back, it's going to be my time to rant. I got a good one for you. Don't go away. We'll be back right after these words. All right, we are back. If you only knew what went on here during the break. All right, now, it is time for... Oh, we're back. All right. Now, you know, Bill has a tremendous sense of humor, as we all know. And I tend to be... I tend to tackle, I think, more weighty issues on the show, and I have a tradition of doing that during my segment, so I think I'm going to stick with that today. And what I want to talk about today is something I think that is critical to society at this juncture, and a lot of people are probably going to get very, well, they're emotionally invested in this, they're probably going to get very upset when we talk about it. So the subject is spandex, a right or a privilege? Bill, what do you think?
Man... It depends on the user, the end user, I have to say, because some people believe it's a right. Here's my thinking on it.
I'm listening.
Spandex should have a limit on how much it can expand.
Ah.
Because certain clothing items should not be made beyond a certain size.
I like that.
If I give you a perfect opportunity.
That would make it a privilege, though, clearly.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly.
Like bikinis
yeah.
for women
oh.
should not go to, like, quadruple XL. Spandex should be, there should be some sort of rule applied there as well.
And, you know, we tend to think of spandex as just like, you know, what are the different kinds? We have bike shorts.
That's kind of the go-to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, bike shorts. And then, you know, I have an admission to make.
Okay. Oh, hold your little chin puff comb while you make this.
This is way over here now, so you can't get your hands on it anymore. All
I'm
right.
bringing one next week.
Look, you have a go. Oh, you keep yours cut really short.
I do.
Okay. I conditioned mine this morning with. Never mind.
that was where okay, I was, so bike shorts.
I get really raunchy any second.
Bike
now.
Shorts.
Okay. back in the, I guess, through most of the 90s, there was a company called Hot Skins. And if you looked at bodybuilding magazines back in the 90s, all the big bodybuilding guys, they wore these very decorative, cool-looking spandex pants.
Are we getting on to the tops that are nothing more than suspenders?
No.
It's like suspenders, but it's like a spaghetti strap suspender.
That's bad news.
Yeah,
I mean, no. These are just the lowers, and the guys who normally wear like a tank top or something.
Okay, yeah.
And I had a friend, very dear friend of mine I've known since I was 16, who back in the 90s owned a store that sold nothing but bodybuilding attire and accessories. So since we went way back, I got basically anything I wanted there at cost. So I had this giant drawer filled with these, and they were very trendy at the time. I mean, everybody was wearing them, right? The Hot Skins. Now,
did you have that drawer available and to impress the ladies? Hey, look.
No.
Well, you flexed.
But here's the thing.
Flex in front of the spandex?
Hot Skins made such an awesome product that today I probably still have 70% of those. And they are so comfortable. They're like a second set of skin. And I really like that in the gym. I mean, who needs the binding of shorts and stuff like that, stuff riding up your keister when you're working out? And this is really like a second set of skin. It alleviates all of those problems. So here we are, well past. The trend has died. And just to show
You're old school.
I'm not trendy, and I don't care what people think. I still wear that stuff to the gym. It's okay. So we've got bike shorts. We've got the Hot Skins, which are long. By the way, the company went out of business when it stopped being trendy.
They probably knew it had a life cycle.
Yes, yeah. I'm sure they did. But there is a new and fascinating form of attire that uses spandex. I'm sure you've seen it. Men tend to be very, very fond of this one. Yoga pants. Oh, here we go.
I am familiar with yoga pants.
Yes. You have a few.
No. I actually have none, but my girlfriend has a whole bunch of them.
There we go.
She usually gets like the Victoria's Secret pink or just the standard whatever. Of course, she's shapely and
What he's trying to say is he has a hot girlfriend, but he wants to be mellow about that.
I don't want to draw her out, but she's incredibly hot. the thing is, she actually does yoga.
Oh.
So not only does she use yoga pants for the sake of doing yoga, I also get the added benefit that, you know, when she's done with yoga, she might still be wearing the pants. It's okay.
Now, I think there's some rule against wearing yoga pants for yoga. Because
not in my house.
I never see him. Oh, she does yoga at home.
She does yoga at home.
Okay. Yeah. Because, you know, I have belonged to a gajillion gyms over the years, and I belong to a couple now, and I rarely see yoga pants come into the yoga class. You're normally wearing sweats and things like that.
Yeah, they're a fashion statement. They're just another set of pants.
They have become
designed for yoga, but nobody wears them in yoga. My girlfriend actually wears yoga pants when she does yoga.
Okay. So now let's make a real hard left turn. Okay. Relevant to yoga pants, though. I read an article the other day. Yep. Now, there's a gal. She is a religious woman. Her flavor of religion is Christian. And she's tattooed and pierced. And she's got a cute little figure. And for years, she wore yoga pants. And the article's written by her. And she says that it started eating at her. And she started to have doubts whether she should continue to wear yoga pants anymore. And I'm not kidding. This sounds a little bizarre, I think. Okay. She went and talked to some friends to sound them out because she was afraid that wearing yoga pants would cause men to unavoidably their eyes drawn to her derriere, and that they would, and I'm not kidding, she wrote this stuff, that it would cause men to look at her rear end lustfully. So she went and talked to her husband, who's also a Christian, and he said, from the article, it didn't say that he told her what to do, but he did say, I hear you, because when I see a woman with a nice figure wearing yoga pants, I find it very hard not to be checking out her butt, right?
Lustfully.
Lustfully, right. And so she said that did it for her, the fact that a good, godly man like her husband, who would never stray from his marriage, admitted that those damn yoga pants made him look at other women's butts lustfully. She didn't want to put any other couples through that.
This reminds me, a couple of years ago, there was a Victoria's Secret model, young, hot girl, got married, Christian, and she retired from being a Victoria's Secret model because she was being bothered by the idea that, you know, these magazines that go out there, she's looking all hot in these poses and these, you know, this underwear that is not necessarily daily wear for a lot of women. It ends up being, you know, it's like the sexy bombshell whatever version for women to wear.
To be worn on a special evening.
Right.
Yes.
And she's, you know, throughout all these magazines and on the website doing all this and all these pictorials that really, now that she's married, that should be reserved just for her husband. So she left this really good career under contract, mm-hmm. and yeah, now she's a stay-at-home wife.
Well, good. I just, you know, and then brings up the whole debate, who's responsible for what? But back to the spandex. I just thought I would share that.
Hoping, okay. I was kind of hoping that we were getting far enough away from spandex we didn't have to go back.
The whole thing is all about the spandex.
Oh,
all right.
Geez.
So we've covered the bike shorts, we've covered the hot skins, we've covered the yoga pants.
What about that stuff that like Olivia Newton-John used to wear during the Let's Get Physical videos back in the early 80s, right?
I think that kind of had to be like the Neanderthal version of...
I think that was like the inception of spandex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The evolution.
Do they still wear that at the gym?
I see women wearing that now that you mentioned that. I do.
Are they of Olivia Newton-John's same age today, or are they just wearing retro?
Well, it comes in two flavors. You have the young, cute girls who... plainly know they can get away with that because they look great, and I appreciate them doing that. And then you have...
Do you stare at their derrieres lustfully?
I never do.
Never.
I never do. No, you
take the higher road?
I do. You know, and I know that sounds kind of stupid, and guys are like, dude, come on, really? No, I mean, do I look, of course. But do I stare? No, because
You notice.
I like to fool myself at least into thinking I'm a gentleman.
Okay. So. I know you, Jay Champion.
I'm not going too overboard on this. Right, right. But staring at somebody's butt, no good. So, got me off track. Oh, so I said there was the young girls that thankfully do that. And then there's like the overweight, middle-aged women who I think wear it because they can't find anything else comfortable to wear in sweatpants or a drag at the gym. You get too hot. And so they wear it. This is where we get into the right of privilege thing because you're like, when you talk about not staring, this is easy, right? You look over and go, ah.
You know,
My eyes!
I have to relay a story. My girlfriend was raised Irish Catholic, and so she has her... red-haired, curly red-haired Irish father, and he's had some hip and bone issues. He was a Marine, retired out of the Marine Corps. He ended up working for an electric company, and you know, he's been a little bit beat up and such. And when she was growing up, he wore spandex, the bike shorts, a lot because they helped hold everything together with his bone structure. He's not an overweight guy,
so sort of almost like a girdle in a sense.
But well,
I
guess,
for
but
bones,
like,
not
yeah,
bad.
For the bones, for yeah, the yeah. for his hips and such, and. she tells me, now he has never told me this, but she tells me that he used to purposely like to get like the really bright lime green or even the pink or the just really bright, vivid colors and wear those, especially when he had to go pick her up or drop her out with her friends.
I love it.
Just to goof with her, you know, just to be the dad that stands out a little bit.
Because
he's got, you know, the puff of the red hair and he's not a tall guy, but he's in good shape.
Having a little fun embarrassing his daughter a bit.
Yeah, just goofing with her and wearing of course it worked because she said that her friends were constantly teasing her about her dad and his spandex bike shorts.
All right, so we've covered all of these. Now I think we're going to get low. We're going to get to the really ugly. The Walmart spandex. The stuff you see when you go to Walmart.
Oh, you're talking about on the Walmartians that are wearing it to Walmart. Not that Walmart sells
no.
it, but it's worn when at Walmart.
Yes.
On the shopping
yes,
trip.
Yes, yes. By the way, here in Pahrump, like Walmart is our mall.
Yeah, just so you know, our Walmart, of the standards of Walmarts, ours is kind of the foundational level.
But it is the cultural center of Pahrump. If you sit there long enough, you will see eventually every single person that lives in this town.
For the most part, yeah. There's very little exception to that. That can get really ugly. Not at our Walmart a little bit, but you'd like go on, you type in like Walmartians and you click images off of Google search.
Right.
And then it really gets ugly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then it comes out, it's,
the people of Walmart, right?
Yeah.
There's actually, you can Google that and get to see the examples. We're probably not going to talk about the Walmart spandex.
I'm already disturbed by this conversation to a bit anyhow. And then we had to bring up the Walmartians. So
we took a real step down.
With that being said, we'll be back right after these words when we come back with my segment and what grinds my gears. Dave's next to me combing his chin puff. Now it's time for... You know what grinds my gears? Fast food restaurants and certain aspects of servers as a whole. I'll give you an example. This last Sunday, I happened to be out at the range doing some shooting throughout the day with some folks. Run a little bit of a course, if you will. And I come back. It's late. I go home, play revolving dogs. I got to switch them in and out of the house, feed them, take a shower, get dressed again. And then go to the store, buy some stuff, come home, and I've recorded the NFC Championship game and the AFC Championship game. Hey, I was born in Seattle and living there when the Seattle Seahawks became an expansion team, so I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan by default, hoping that they repeat. I don't generally watch football, but since they won the Super Bowl last year, I've dedicated myself to watching every one of their games that I can this year. Luckily, I missed two games that they both lost, so... thank you, programmers, for Dish Network. Anyhow, on the way home, I've had all this stuff to do. I don't know that I even have any food that I'm willing to stand around and cook. So I go by the local Taco Bell, and I order a 12-pack of mixed tacos. The menu board says $14.99. Okay, that's fine. I order them. Girl on the other end says, check the message board, the menu board, make sure it's proper. And I said, yeah, except... you're charging me $16.99 for tacos that are supposed to be $14.99, according to the memo board. She acknowledges to me that a few other people have recognized that throughout the day. However, management changed the price. They just haven't gone out and changed menu board yet. Well, that's called a bait and switch law. I'm not really too worried about the $2, but I did inform the kid as I pulled up and the 15-year-old boy that was behind the counter, whatever it was, through the drive-thru, and he seemed to not care. But what really grinded my gears is when I got home. I had 12 tacos, 22 packets of fire sauce, 2 napkins. Dave, what is it about drive-thrus where they give you the food that you order, but all the ancillary things that would come with it are somehow not proportionate to the actual order?
Oh, yeah. I don't do a lot of fast food, but I've had the exact same experience. You know, it's like, okay, there's 4 people in the car and we're ordering for 4 people. We need to get on the road and move out, you know. So it's one of those times I'll do fast food. And you're handing out all the food and, okay, everybody's got their food and their drink and their french fries and whatever. A napkin. Like one napkin in the bag. It's like, really?
Have you ever had, now for me, 12 packets would have been perfect because I usually use 1 packet of fire sauce. And I can usually use the same napkin for 3 or 4 tacos. That's okay. But normally one person does not sit down and guzzle a dozen tacos.
Yeah.
I hadn't eaten all day. I'd been up for 14 hours. I had snacked on like some trail mix. And I think I had 2 or 3 bottles of water and some, I don't know, Powerade or something. So I was hungry. So I powered through that dozen tacos. And it hurt, but I got it done. But the point is, 2 napkins, I mean, how did you not know I was bringing this home to my kids and we're 6 people going to eat?
Right.
Have you ever done the thing, like you say you're on the road trip and you go and you say, go to some burger joint, you get a bunch of different stuff. And they give you a separate bag loaded with all of the ketchups, the salts, the peppers, and the napkins.
Sure.
Yeah, okay, I get that. But here's the thing. I doubt there's been a study of it. Could be probably difficult to study. But I would imagine the restaurants that don't have any control point on the condiment packets, mm-hmm. I would imagine about 30% of those actually get used. The other 70% are relegated to the trash, or if it happens to be some an apartment or a dormitory where young adults live,
frat house,
a drawer.
Right.
Right. How many people out there had a drawer of condiment packets for years? I did. And then when I turned to be about 30 years old, I realized, why do I have a drawer full of condiment packets?
Right, right.
All that went in the trash and it stopped. My oldest daughter is 24 now. When she was living in Vegas with friends years ago, I think she's 19 years old. Of course, you go over to her place, say hi, and they have a drawer filled with condiment packets. None in the fridge. It's like, hey, where's your mayo and your mustard? Oh, they're in the drawer.
Yeah.
Then little onesie packets. And you know, we were talking about this at lunch just for a moment. One of the burger joints I like in Las Vegas is In-N-Out Burger. It's a California franchise.
Right.
And if you go into In-N-Out or you order through the drive-thru, they'll give you a limited amount of condiments and napkins. They don't just reach in there with the biggest hand. I want to see how many I can get. It's like a competition at Taco Bell and some of these other places. How many can I get and throw in there?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how much the restaurants are paying on these things, probably pennies to the packet. But those pennies in a single shift add up to several dollars.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the day, add up to many. The end of the week, the month, and the year have got to be thousands and thousands of dollars.
I'd imagine so.
And people like me, I don't like wasting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to recycle six-day-old tacos. It's not going to happen. But don't give me more stuff than I have to have. not at this point in my life. I have no need to do that. But you know, like all of the extra packets of hot sauce or mustard or ketchup or whatever it is, all of that stuff, I get a little ticked.
Yeah.
It's like, look, this is waste. You know, we grew the tomatoes. Everybody brewed the stuff, blah, blah, blah. Make this stuff last a little long. You got 73 cases of ketchup in the back. Doesn't mean they all need to go out this week.
Yeah. You know, and I'm 1,000 years old. And when I was 16, I worked at a lumberyard. And it was just sort of the precursor to places like Home Depot and things like that. I don't think there was more than a handful of these gigantic type indoor, outdoor, everything you could play in the whole country. And I worked at one of those places when I was 16.
Did you sell any building materials to Noah?
I could have. Yeah, he's in the room going, yeah.
I'm the art guy.
Yeah. So I would go down the street at lunch to Burger King. And man, back then, the Whopper was like something you'd make at home.
Oh, it's big.
Big, juicy patties,
yeah.
Fresh vegetables. And because I stopped eating fast food a long time ago. And then one time, I guess it maybe been like 8 years since I'd eaten fast food, but I got off the freeway from some big, stuck in traffic for hours, and I was ravenous, and I wasn't going to make it home without dying. So I stopped at Burger King, remembering the Whoppers of my yesteryear, and I got a Whopper. I'm like, what is this? Now, the parallel that I'm drawing is to the employees. When I was a boy and you went to McDonald's or you went to Burger King or someplace like that, there were some pretty competent people working there, and you never had to really worry about anything. Now, fast forward to whenever the years were, the final years of fast food, I could not leave a fast food establishment if it was a to-go order. I could not leave a fast food establishment without checking every single item in the bag.
To make sure it was right.
Yes.
And it probably wasn't most of the time.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, I remember this when I was in high school. If you ordered a Taco Supreme, it was a big taco.
Yes.
Now a Taco Supreme, it has all the same stuff on it, but it's this size.
Yeah.
The Taco Supreme's about the same amount of money it was then. It's just a third the size.
Now I got to tell you, Taco Bell, right, been around forever. It was around when I was a teenager. And I grew up in Southern California. My teen years was in the 70s.
Okay.
Not only had the slogan, just say no to drugs, not even been coined yet, in the area that I grew up, which is a middle class area, it was like the bedroom community to the Hollywood industry. You know, it was like, if you went to the parents and said, should I not do drugs? They'd be like, why?
I mean, it was a pretty pro-drug environment, right? And perhaps there was some marijuana smoking going on. And Taco Bell, do they still have these tacos? You pull them out and like 80% of the shell is like seeped through with oil. It's like there's the dry edge around it, and then like...
Not at Taco Bell, but I have to tell you, if you go to Jack in the Box...
Oh, that's
you
what get it was! Jack in the Box.
Yeah, they're still a greasy taco. Jack's Tacos rock. They used to have that television commercials, and I have to say, we don't have a Jack in the Box in the town we live in.
Uh-huh.
But when I find myself in a bigger city, and it happens to be a day where I'm willing to have fast food...
Yeah.
If there's a Taco Bell and I can manage a Taco Supreme, I will, because those are really excellent tacos. They are greasy,
right. Nasty,
kind of stuff you'd make at home.
I'm not even talking about the Supremes. I'm talking about the basic taco.
They're great tacos.
And
Supremes just got extra stuff on top.
You know, perhaps people smoked marijuana back in Southern California back in the 70s.
Maybe.
And perhaps they got what people get from marijuana, which is the munchies, and perhaps Jack in the Box was a handy place to go.
You know, there was one other thing I want to talk about with servers, and I'm going to give an example of it. And what it is it's servers that either aren't thinking or are thinking and trying to force you to overtip. Now, I'm a pretty generous tipper as it is. You know, 20% is my go-to tip. You are either going to work to get a better tip or you're going to work to get a lesser tip. But we start at 20% when I walk in the door. And when I go to a bar and I get a drink, I commonly tip a dollar a drink. Unless it's a nicer place, more expensive drinks, it'll be $2 a drink.
Okay.
Every time no matter where I go, it's what I... And a lot of people don't tip drinks at all.
Oh,
I don't get it. But you should. That's cheap. But a buck a drink...
My thing is take...
Because I'm figuring a good bartender should be pouring about 40, 50, 60 drinks an hour in a busy place. Mm-hmm. If you get a buck a drink, that's a pretty good wage.
Well, I've always believed in the adage, take care of your bartender.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, if I tip a buck a drink, and then maybe on my third drink, I might tip $2 or $3, or at the end of the night, like whatever change is left over, I got a few singles laying there, mm-hmm. I'll just leave that there. So, you know, I try to take care of them. I was at an event last Thursday, and it was at a nice Italian restaurant in Las Vegas. And
I saw that
went
on
there.
Your Facebook page.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I went there with it was a political event. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky was there, keynote speaker. I went there with the ladies, a friend of mine that's big into politics, who's, you know, just amazing at what she does in politics.
Yes, she is indeed.
So we go there, and I asked her if she wanted to grab a drink. So I ordered a pair of rum and Diet, Captain Morgan and Diet. All right, so they poured them. $24.
Hello.
$12 a drink. Okay. And they have an ounce of Captain Morgan. Okay. That $24 that I paid them, I could have bought a 1.75 liter.
That's what I was thinking.
For that. So $24, all right, I hand him a 20 and a 10. He gives me back a 5 and a 1. So either I have to over tip this guy.
Right.
Or I got to short him and look like the a-hole because he didn't give me 6 singles.
Right.
Okay. And it actually happened to us at lunch today.
Oh.
Okay. I got a $1.40 back.
Right.
Or $1.60 back when I gave her $10 for my shrimp tacos. Good thing I had a couple of singles in my pocket because she gave me, I gave her 20. So she gave me a 10, a 1, and 60 cents. So you get $1.60 or, you know, what do I do? So it's one of these things where I've started getting into the practice of break this down so I can properly tip you. Don't force me to overtip you.
Yeah, I'm with you.
We'll be right back right after these words. Welcome back. We are going to get into the viewer mailbag,
yep.
Which, by the way, you can always send us emails to this email address here. It is the DaveAndBillShow@gmail.com. Anything you want us to talk about, send it in. We'll go through them, all the questions that come in throughout the week, and we'll get it figured out when it comes to time to air the show. And Dave, we're going to talk about one today that came to one of our listeners about what is our favorite choice of weapons, personal, whatever we've had in our arsenal or used,
mm-hmm.
Be it in service or anything such as that, handgun, shotgun, rifle, things such as that. So I figured we'd chat a little bit about that.
Okay. You want me to lead off with handgun?
Sure.
Okay. First of all, a little history, okay? When I came out of the military,
I don't think it was because of my military time. Just my preference was the 1911. And so I was a 1911 guy for a number of years. And then when I got into law enforcement, that changed. Okay, and I went with the Glock. And I went to Glock school and became a Glock certified law enforcement handgun instructor. And then I became a Glock certified armorer. And back when I first started carrying a Glock, this will blow a lot of people's minds who are younger, there was one Glock in the whole world. It was a Glock 17.
Glock 17.
That was it. Okay. And so I carried a Glock 17 for a while. And then they came out with the Glock 19. So I started carrying that off duty. And then they came out with a 40 cal. So my duty weapon became the 22, and my off-duty weapon became the 23. And I was very happy with that for all that time. I mean, there's nothing wrong with what I call, jokingly, combat Tupperware. But when I no longer had to use those and I could move into something else, I went back to the 1911. And in my mind, the sort of conundrum about the 1911 is that inexpensive 1911s, you know, if you're talking anywhere from, say, the $500 range to about the $1,000 range, whether you're going to have a reliable firearm is, I think, questionable. When you get up into $1,300, $1,400, I think you can start looking for reliability. And if you really are a professional and you really want bulletproof reliability out of your 1911 for the rest of your life, you're probably talking $2,000 or above. Okay. And you know this. I'm telling the audience, I'm looking at Bill, but Bill knows all this. So I have a couple of very high-end 1911s. And, of course, there's a lot of criticism of the 1911 in the sense that, you know, depending on what magazines you use, it's someplace between, you know, 7 to 11 rounds. And I certainly understand that. When I was had to, in uniform...
We still have shotguns and rifles to get to in this segment, Dave.
sorry. When I had to go into a building in uniform and I didn't know what I was facing and I had to perhaps fight my way in, I like the high capacity with multiple magazines and everything. Now my thing is if I've got, say, 17 rounds on my person, spare magazine or something, you know, if I can't fight my way out of a situation with that many rounds, I probably can't fight my way out of that situation at all.
And you and I did a YouTube video several years ago now.
We did.
Using a Glock with a higher capacity than a 1911. I think it was almost 2-to-1 ratio. And how many rounds you can get off. So you can actually search it at just Bill Carnes, Dave Champion. It was 7 years ago or so.
Yeah. You'll see us that both of us are standing on a shooting range. And I think I'm wearing a black T-shirt.
We're shooting through. Yeah. It was from some time ago. Now, I have to say, I call myself a recovering Glockaholic. I have been a 1911 guy for sake of argument for about a decade now. But formerly big into Glocks. I still own more Glocks than I do 1911s. I get what you're saying about the expense of a good 1911. I have a completely custom-designed, custom-built 1911 that I have about $3,500 invested in, and probably 3 or 4 years to get the thing working right between different proper gunsmiths.
But that's because you did the titanium thing.
Well, there was a lot of reasons behind it. There's a lot of design features, but titanium frame, carbon steel slide, and blah, blah, blah. But I got to tell you, if I were to boil all of the defensive handguns of the world down into one and pick the best all-around handgun, not the best for any one feature, but best all-around, I would recommend a Glock 23. I own one of those. I've owned two at one time, and I would like to own several. It is a mid-size, so you could carry it if it were a duty gun, or you could carry it concealed. 13 plus one rounds of 40 Smith & Wesson, and it will handle the full power plus P loads, if you like, and ease of operation without any problems, not really susceptible to hot or cold. So if I were to boil everything down, it would be that. The Springfield XD is another good gun. I don't like the grip safety on the back. The reason the 1911 is a 1911 was the 1909 version didn't have the grip safety, and the Army told John Moses Browning, if it flops out of our crappy holster and hits the ground while we're on horseback, we don't want it to go bang. So he integrated the grip safety. XD integrated that as well. Smith M&P is another decent version like that as well. But like a 1911-esque gun that I can't stand at all is the one that John Moses Browning put out later, the Browning High Power. Hate those guns. Yeah. Can't stand those.
One of the best things I ever heard, and I think you'll probably agree with this, is if you want something you can pull out, shoot, throw in the sock drawer, pull it out 6 months later, shoot it, throw it back in the sock drawer, and so forth, combat Tupperware is the right thing. If you want to have a relationship with your firearm, get a high-end 1911.
All right. Let's talk about shotguns here.
You lead off since I blabbed away.
I will go with defensive-style shotguns because my guns are defensive-style. I have a I have an over and under that I'll use for skeet, trap, or if I want to go bird hunting. But I have two shotguns that I like for tactical guns that I personally own. One is a Remington 870, mm-hmm. which is all set up with proper tactical gear, 18 and a half inch barrel. It's got a Vancomp system on it, the cool nice. Sights, side saddle, extended mag tube, integrated Surefire light on the fore end, blah, blah, blah. Remington 870. The other one that I really dig, you're jumping up in price range now, is the Benelli M4. Right. And in fact, mine's the Benelli Model 1014, which is the M4 version they released like 1500 onto the civilian market when they were first putting them out to the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. and they labeled them the M14. Then they filled the Marine Corps order, and now the ones on the market they call the M4. It's the exact same gun, different designation, but I have one of those.
Okay. Those are great shotguns. My preference used to be, we're in sync on the Remington, I used to run a Remington 1187, semi-automatic. I had the Surefire fore-end and all of that.
Yeah, that gun went down, and you ran my 870 one time
yes,
in an advanced
right.
course. Yeah.
And I had the gate modified, so it was a little bit less cumbersome. And that when I got it the way I wanted, sort of like your 1911, when I got it the way I wanted it, it was stunning. But then I decided that what I prefer is a Sega, okay, which is, as you know, based on the AK-47 design, and it takes a box-fed magazine, right?
Yep.
So instead of having the vertical tube along the barrel, now you can simply rock and lock.
Good, rather inexpensive
yes.
shotgun. It needs a little bit of work on it to make it reliable.
It does.
I'll tell you, I have never come across a Sega yet that didn't need to have some sort of proper gunsmithing to it to make it smooth and reliable. They just don't come out of the box ready to go.
Right. And most
like a lot of 1911s don't.
Right. And, you know, you're probably going to want whatever you want on the, you know, for the, on the front end, you know, like you've got the Vancomp on yours and so forth. It's funny. Some people pronounce them Sega. Some people Sega.
Sega,
yeah.
Whatever. I interchange it. Al-Qaeda.
there you go.
Whatever.
But the Sega, when it comes, is pretty much bare bones. So understand that when you get a Sega, you're going to have to do some customization. You and I are kind of...
It's a naked Barbie that
yeah.
you have to accessorize yourself.
Nice. Okay.
Which brings us to rifles.
Rifles.
Yeah. And I got to tell you,
by the way, we're not talking about precision rifle.
No. We're talking about battle rifles.
There you go.
Yeah, battle rifles. My go-to battle rifle at this point in time is a built AR-15. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't believe that this is the best rifle in the world.
Is that the one, by the way, we shot with a suppressor on it out of the course recently?
Yes,
okay.
I do. I do have a class
when we shot
three.
When we shot at the students?
Yes, we
okay.
shot. Well, over. Yeah.
Well, we'll explain that another time.
We didn't shoot at the students, but yeah, I actually did the Form 4 paperwork, got the class 3, had the suppressor on it. But yeah, that's my go-to AR-15. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, if I could choose any gun to fill the role of that one. And there's a number of reasons I have that gun. First of all, I'm invested in a whole bunch of accessories in it. There's a fair amount of time and effort and money, finances involved mm-hmm. in that. The ammunition is relatively inexpensive and very plentiful. So expense and our lack of expense and availability of ammunition is very good. And parts and accessories for those things are everywhere. I once taught a class that had 60 students in it. Everyone had an AR-15. No two were the same. They really call them like Barbie dolls for men because you can accessorize them however you want.
The Mr. Potato Head rifle.
There you go, yeah. But if I could actually boil it down to one rifle that I think is the best one in the world, it would be the Galil.
Oh, yes.
Which is based on an AK-47 style action, all forged steel.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis took the AK-47 and re-engineered it and improved it in every little way that it could be. Forged it, there are no interchangeable parts, but the Galil. And there's a few different versions and a few different calibers, but unbelievably fantastic guns.
And my go-to, and I distinguish what I call full-size battle rifles, which would be something chambered in like .308, versus what I call a personal battle rifle, which is, you know...
Below .308.
Correct, below .308. and, of course, mine for years now has been the AK-47. And the reason is because you cannot kill that sucker.
Yeah, and you've got a couple of them that Rifle Dynamics put together
correct.
For you.
Correct. Jim Fuller and his people did a splendid job.
Unbelievable. Yeah, a lot of guys that you and I know mm-hmm. have these AKs that Jim Fuller put
there's
together.
There's even
Rifle
like memes all over social media now about Rifle Dynamics. It's pretty
yeah,
funny.
Yeah.
We knew Jim when he was out at Front Sight.
He doesn't like us mentioning that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. He took a couple classes out there.
Yeah, we knew him and worked with him briefly at some place.
Yeah. And I don't blame him.
No, I don't blame him either. Yeah, you would want to put that away.
But in fact, bleep that.
Yeah. Jim's a good guy. And so I've got a couple pieces with that. And my primary AK is, in a sense, like the Galilis, a solid steel block milled out. And it's heavier than the average AK.
It is. I fired that gun.
Well, that's why I go to the gym, so I can tote that thing around.
Yeah. See, I would rather have a lighter gun and tote more ammo. Oh. That's me.
Well, you know, it's funny because you saw when we ran that class recently, I limited the students to two magazines, and that was it. And through the entire 2 days, they never once went dry in any of the exercises, even if they were prolonged exercises.
Yes, ammo management.
So they learned that two magazines you don't need. You know, you see these guys in the movies, you know. But, okay. However, I've sort of gotten away a little bit from the AK, and the one I'm developing right now, I'm working to get it where I want it completely, is the SIG 556R, which is a SIG chambered in 7.62x39, takes the same AK magazines, rocked and locked, but because it's got that Austrian engineering, it is a fair amount more accurate than an AK is going to be, even with an accurization job. And it's got all the rails and everything. You don't have to add that as an aftermarket product. So that's pretty much where I've
What's the
down.
Weight on that gun?
Light. I don't know what it is, but it's a hell of a lot lighter than my AK.
Okay, so we have about 30 seconds to sum this up. I will go with a Glock or a 1911, mm-hmm. followed by an 870 or an M4, followed by a either an M4-style AR-15 mm-hmm. or Galil.
Okay. 1911, certainly, if I was going to back that up with polymer, it would be the M&P and the Sega, followed by the Remington, and then the AK, and now the SIG.
Great.
We are out of time. Hope it was valuable. We'll talk to you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.